Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the next installment of Unspun, episode, 76? I'm your host, Jan Irvin. I'm joined today by Jacob Duhlman. First, I have a couple of notes, a couple of thank yous to read off for people who donated things and stuff. I'm not sure if Jacob had gotten any donations from when we asked for a computer donation help for him on episode 74, but... Anyway, thanks to Camille for the books. Camille sent me the Biology of Doom. Now, this is a nuts book to start reading. I've also gotten some research out of Mexico, which is kind of rare. Jose sent me some of his magazines, Mota Magazine, in which he cites our work. So it's actually getting out into the world out there. And so thanks for that. Also, thank you to 6-year-old Kane, who sent another donation. And he sends a little letter with it talking about how he and his mom were studying our 50 Years of Flower Power. And he was watching it before bedtime. So thanks so much. I really love getting donations in the mail, too. I appreciate the support from PayPal, from Bitcoin, etc. It's really awesome, though, when you get a letter from a 6-year-old, for your work and, a new generation of people growing up aware. At least we hope we're helping people understand how confusing and what a labyrinth this world we live in can actually be. And so thanks for all your support and donations, etc., folks. If you enjoy the show, please make sure you go to the website, support the show, and there's a link right there in the bottom of the YouTube thing as well. Jacob, welcome back to the show. We've got some great stuff today. We didn't get to finish off a lot of what we had hoped to cover in the last episode, and we're going to explain where the title of this episode comes from this time, which we actually forgot last time, so that was pretty funny. But welcome back, Jacob.
Well, there's so much going on in the last episode. I mean, can you play this?
There was a lot of meat and potatoes in that one, that's for sure. So
I've kind of stumbled into a rabbit hole, and I found a lot more information. I've done a lot more studying into the dictionary. I thought maybe we could start off. I have a little outline that I made up for the show. Maybe we could start off with just kind of refreshing the audience on who Joseph Scaliger is, why we're interested in him, and his role with chronology. So Joseph Scaliger was a 7th, or I guess I should say a 16th century scholar who was a professor at the University of Leiden, but I believe he also was part of the University of Paris for a time. He's responsible for creating the timeline that we now see in our history books, which details ancient history all the way up to modern times, or at least for Scaliger up to his time. So a lot of those dates that we're seeing, Anatoly Fomenko sees a lot of discrepancies in these chronological orders. So I've kind of taken interest in Joseph Scaliger and trying to figure out where he's coming from. So it's kind of like the who of the grammar part.
And this is what our 5th show, and you started out on this path researching General Tom Harrison, Brigadier General Thomas Harrison. And,
yes.
And then that led into the Gallants and the Fabian Socialists. And then all of us were looking at Fomenko all at the same time, because we were looking at all of the fake history and also from my Spies in Academic Clothing article, and looking at how intelligence cells operate in fake history and the reporting of things. And then we were looking at how archaeological things were faked and so many different things that are potentially fake. And then all of us kind of within a week of one another all went, wow, there's probably more here to Fomenko. And then to credit you, you dove deep into the Scaliger work, Joseph Scaliger, and looking into all of that. And you found quite a number of excellent tidbits that Fomenko didn't find. And we will be sending this research to Fomenko here soon as well, because it really substantiates huge chunks of his primary thesis. This isn't going into like his 2013 book, The Way Things Really Were, but this is really more and is about his books, especially the early books, and history, fiction or science, chronology, like one and two connected on the feed here. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Okay, hopefully we're still going. I'm not sure what happened there. We lost the feed there for a second, folks. Let's see if it's back up here. Yeah, it looks, I hope it's up. So, anyway, sorry about that, folks. I think we're back up again. Anyway, so just kind of rounding out how we got here and looking at all of this. So there is, in fact, a lot to question about Scaliger and even Scaliger's own history. What you've been discovering is that basically it's all been faked. So anyway, I don't want to take the wind away from your sails there. So, you know, let's get into it. Let's hit your outline and just, you know, dig into all of this stuff. Hopefully, and now it's frozen again. I hope we're not down again. But anyway, just
I want to. We should make sure that this is good, that it's running before I read this quote. Just because if it's not running and they miss this, it's kind of key to the entire foundation.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've got it going. People are saying it's good in the chat room. So hopefully we're still broadcasting there. So anyway, if we're not, people let us know in the chat room right away. I'm trying to pay attention to that. So I think we are okay.
All right. So this quote that I'm going to read is from A General Dictionary, Historical and Critical, Volume 10. Now, this is the book that I was reading from 2 weeks ago in part one in regards to Julius Caesar Scaliger's biography. This article is in volume 10, which I just stated, and it's in regards to a dissertation concerning the project, which is the dictionary. So this is kind of the authors kind of writing an essay about their project and what they were doing. So this quote that I found at Scaliger is quite interesting, and I'll just dive right into it because it's quite lengthy. It will be readily granted that there are a numberless multitude of errors in books, if we consider that the writings of the greatest men have not been exempt from them, and that the lowest critic discovers many in them. How often do we meet in the contents and indexes of the most trifling books, Scaliger notatus hallucinatio Scaligeri, i.e. Scaliger found fault with the blunder of Scaliger, and such like. Alexander Morris looked upon this as the bad affectation of a vainglorious author who endeavored to make the world take notice of him. This may possibly be, but no learned man will deny that Scaliger may be justly censured on a vast number of occasions. We need no other proof of this but Salmasius' work, in which Scaliger is in every instant found guilty of errors. And right after this, there's a footnote for K, and I think I should just dive right into that footnote and read it right away in this order. This footnote reads, "I shall forbear to speak of the charges with which Cyapius, the most formidable and furious of all the critics, brought against him. For this would be too odious, viz. That he had committed 500 errors in a piece, but 120 pages concerning the antiquity of his family. It is very certain that, among these 500 lies which he is charged, a great many of them are just. To prove this, we need but read the answer which Scaliger and his friends made, and the reply made to them." And that's the end of the footnote. Now, continuing on, "we need no other proof of this but Salmasius' works, in which Scaliger is in every instant found guilty of errors. He, Salmasius, indeed does not name him, and hints at him only by the pompous title Vir Magnus, Vir Sumus, i.e. a great man, an extraordinary man. But these great compliments do not lessen the reality of the error when the censure is justly grounded. Salmasius, who had not the same reasons for behaving so respectfully towards the rest of the literati, exasperated some of them, who censured his writings without mercy. He defended himself and attacked them in turn. The contest was carried on chiefly between him and Petavius, the Jesuit, and carried on at such a rate that scarce anything but death could interrupt it. It may be affirmed that these were two champions worthy of each other, and that no gladiators were ever better matched than they. For it would not be just to determine the matter from what those have said who are both judges and parties in that conceit. And there's a little footnote for L here. This footnote reads, as Father Labbé and his Chronologie Francois, I'm just going to skip to the annotations there, Petavius says he, the most learned man in the world, died the 11th of November in the 17th year of his age. Salmasius, who tried to strengthen with him in some points of grammar, but who was far inferior to him in all other respects, Impar Longe Congressus Achille, died the 3rd of September. See the remainder of the article, Petavius.
And this is about Dionysius Petavius, who was basically the student of Joseph Scaliger.
Yes, and he picked up his chronology after Scaliger passed away.
Right, and both, and also in these quotes that we're going to be reading, you have basically found pretty strong evidence that both of them were Jesuits. You know, we had evidence before that Dennis Petavius was, but now there's pretty solid evidence that Joseph Scaliger was as well.
Actually, no, I don't think that was in the notes. I think you might have misread something there. What I found actually is that Joseph Scaliger, who was his father was Catholic and is said to have been buried in a Catholic cemetery. Joseph Scaliger joined the Reformation.
I'll search it. I thought I had seen it, that he was. So my apologies if that was in error. Petavius, it does say Petavius, the Jesuit right there. And then let's see. Oh, yeah. Scaliger... the biography of Scaliger is contained in the original dictionary of On One is Laid, the original dictionary, Le Dictionnaire Historique et Critique, from 1647. He was raised by a Calvinist minister and went to a Jesuit college at Toulouse and became Roman Catholic a month later, 1669.
That's Pierre Bayle. That's the originator of this dictionary.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, you're skipping ahead here. We'll get to this a little bit later.
Got it. All right, go ahead.
Okay, so where were we here? Okay, so I just read about Petavius. So
Psiopius. Sorry, somebody's funny note in the...
Yeah, no, it's kind of like a psiop, but he's spelled differently. It's S-C-I-O-P-P-I-U-S. Okay, so they, Salmasius and Petavius, were the two most learned men in France. We've heard that quote before with Scaliger. And it was in their power not only to enlighten the age in which they lived, but also to do great honor to it by their long contests, if to the shame of learning they had not infected them with too violent venom of their choler, which dictated to each very near as many injurious expressions as words. None of the rest of Salmasius's antagonists were able to return him blow for blow. I mean, to discover as many errors in his writings as he discovered in theirs. But they nevertheless proved to him that he was frequently mistaken. What man can doubt, after what has been said, that the harvest of this kind of errors would be very great? Where will they not be found, since we meet with them in the works of Scaliger, Salmasius, and such like? And what man that would be easy after he had been convicted of errors from the reflection of the many errors which have been found in the compositions of the most learned men? So, there we see the kind of where the authors of this dictionary are coming from, where they kind of see the foundations of a lot of criticism for history. I'm trying to see how I could link this to the Dictionnaire Historique, which is kind of where we're going towards next. Pierre Bayle was reading, I'm jumping ahead. I should just stick to my outline. Okay, so why is this dictionary important that I'm reading from? This dictionary is important because it contains an original biography of the Scaligers, not contained in the original dictionary upon which this one is laid. The original dictionary, Le Dictionnaire Historique et Critique, is written by Pierre Bayle, who was born on the 18th of November in 1647 and died on the 28th of December 1706. That's 30 years before this dictionary I'm reading from was released. He was raised by a Calvinist minister and went to a Jesuit college at Toulouse and became a Roman Catholic a month later in 1669. After 17 months, he returned to Calvinism and fled to Geneva. A Huguenot who lived in Holland fled his native France due to religious persecution. This dictionary is born out of his notes of errors and omissions found in Louis Moreri's Grand Dictionnaire Historique. Now, Louis Moreri is interesting. He was a French priest and encyclopedist. He was born in Bergeron, in a village in the ancient province of Provence. Let's see here. Let's get to kind of just the juice of the actual dictionary here. Louis Moreri studied humanities and Draguignan, and later rhetoric and philosophy at the Jesuit College of Aix-en-Provence, and then studied theology, obtaining his doctoral degree, and was ordained as priest in Lyon. During his stay in Lyon, he published several works, among them La Pratique de la Perfection Chrétienne et Religieuse, pardon me for butchering the French, a translation of the work of the Spanish Jesuit theologian Alonso Rodriguez. It was probably in Lyon that he met Samuel Chapuzot, who claimed to have first given him the idea of writing his encyclopedia. Now, I could go and I digress on Chapuzot. He's interesting because he's credited as being with a number of the firsts, kind of like the people who are first in the comment section. he's the first writer to introduce satire to French farce, and the first to set a play in China, which is interesting. Later, he composed Tavernier's famous travel guides from Notes and Dictation. Through this task, it seems to have been forced upon him, much against his will, by the king, who was Louis XIV. Chapuzot also wrote sermons, odes, dictionaries, and geographical books, and was still working on his Nouveau Dictionnaire almost up to his death. Now, in 1675, we're going back to Moreri and his Grand Dictionary, which is what inspired Pierre Bayle and his dictionary, which inspired the dictionary that I am reading from today. Quite a connection. Okay, so in 1675, shortly after publishing the first dictionary of his encyclopedia, Moreri accompanied his bishop to Paris, where he became acquainted with Simon Arnauld, Marquis de Pomponne, then the Minister of Foreign Affairs. 3 years later, he was hired to be a tutor for Pomponne's children. During this time, he worked on a second edition of his encyclopedia. In 1680, midway through the printing of the second edition, he died of tuberculosis. Let's see here. Is there anything else that's kind of worthy of reading in this? I think we could kind of move on to the next incarnation. So, Dictionnaire Historique et Critique. The overwhelming... Okay, now this is Pierre Bayle's dictionary, which is critical of Moreri's dictionary. The overwhelming majority of the entries were devoted to individual people, whether historical or mythical, but some articles treated religious beliefs and philosophies. Many of the more controversial ideas in the book were hidden away in the voluminous footnotes, or they were slipped into articles on seemingly uncontroversial topics. And everything I'm finding about this book, Thomas Birch, John Peter Bernard, and Lachman, they have maintained that sense in their editions of the British Lives, because I'm reading original articles when I'm reading this about the Scaligers. And they've hidden all the good stuff in the footnotes. Now, I decided to kind of look and see where the encyclopedias kind of take the Scaliger biography once it kind of appears in Thomas Birch's dictionary, a general dictionary, historical and critical. And what I found is that a lot of the footnotes are omitted further along as we progress up the historical ladder into towards the present. It almost seems as though various scholars throughout the years just kind of cherry pick from the base article, and they never look at that footnote for K or J or whatever, H, and then go down and see that contradiction. You know, there's a lot of contradictions there in the footnotes. There's the accepted history, and then there's the actual history and the criticism and all the footnotes. That's what this dictionary is about.
So basically, the historians later on just perpetuated Scaliger's bogus history and omitted all of the footnotes to the extent that the footnotes eventually disappeared in the official history.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, there's actual book citations, page citations. You know, they actually names names. And if as you further along you go, they just start stripping away those citations. They don't mark them where they are supposed to be. All the margins, we now see them as just being clean and pristine. But if you look at this book, the books in the 1700s, they use those margins for notes. And they made sure to put all their footnotes and all their books and all their citations in those margins. And then if you look also into like the 19th century, if you look at some of the scholarly works that are there, a lot of scholars like to paraphrase their works and their paragraphs and put those in the margins. And if you look at those paraphrases, And then you go back over to the table of contents. The table of contents is essentially one long paraphrase of the entire book. It's fascinating stuff, but you don't see that anymore. I wish we kind of did do that because...
Right. Well, you know, so...
The contents.
Well, and then, you know, and that's why I always try to put my footnotes in the page of what I'm working on, or at least at the bottom of the page, you know, but yeah. That's, you know, it's like, that's a great idea. Just have it right there on the side so that you're always, you know, just referencing and reading it right along. But, you know, footnotes and primary citations makes for smart people, and, you know, we can't have that.
No, we'll start questioning things and making the world a better place.
Yeah, instead of just accepting what the words say at face value, they might actually start checking the primaries and saying, wait a second, that's not what that says.
He wasn't a Prince of Verona? What? That was all a fraud! So this dictionary is kind of interesting. He influenced some other people in the Enlightenment. I mean, we could kind of follow through this, but I mean, we're already almost 30 minutes into the show, and I'm on page 4 of my notes, so I think we should just kind of skip that.
Yeah, I'm kind of showing your notes up on screen every once in a while here as we go along, too.
Okay. I mean, there, we could get some humor out of it, but I think we should just proceed to the first English translation.
Yeah, in this way, I can just block myself out, you know, because I've got a face for radio, and then we can just have you up there and your notes next to you.
That'd be easier for people to follow along, that's for sure.
Right.
Okay, so... the first English translation of Pierre Bayle's Le Dictionnaire Historique et Critique was an historical and critical dictionary, which was printed in 1710, which was shortly after Bayle's death. It was translated by Pierre de Mézieux, who was born in 1666 or 1673, and died in June 1745. That's interesting, but I mean, not necessarily unheard of, where records might not have been kept quite as well at the time for certain individuals. But anyway, I don't know Mézieux's lineage, where his family comes from. Digression. He's a translator and biographer of Pierre Bayle. Now, as we move up now to 1734, Thomas Birch, John Peter Bernard, John Lockman, they now want to take this book and they want to add British lives to it because they kind of notice that it's left wanting of a lot of the histories of England and Ireland and Wales. So the authors of the articles contained within a general dictionary, historical and critical, are Reverend Thomas Birch, born 23rd of November 1705, died 9th of January 1766. He was a Quaker whose original articles, upon which he wrote most of the English lives, are marked with a T at the end. Reverend John Peter Bernard, who died in 1750 and has no date of birth, is a Huguenot minister educated at the University of Leiden, where Joseph Scaliger was a professor. His 63 articles, original articles, are marked with a P at the end. And English author John Lockman, born 1698, died 1771, is responsible for fresh translations of the French written by Pierre Bayle. So this dictionary takes Mézieux's translations, sets them aside, they take Bayle's originals, and they retranslate them again in a fresh perspective. Just curious, if I knew the French, I would like to take Mézieux's dictionary, or Bayle's dictionary, and kind of, I guess you could, and check the translations between the two. That'd be a fun study.
Okay, which, you're on page 5 now?
I'm on page, saying 4. Yeah, I'm on 5.
Okay.
Okay, so the efforts of Thomas Birch and John Peter Bernard for their contributions to the dictionary led to their admission as fellows of the Royal Society. Sir Isaac Newton, born 25th of December 1642, died 20th of March 1726 or 27, was a skeptic of chronology and was president of the Royal Society. So for more on Newton's skepticism of chronology, see his book, The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended, printed posthumously in 1728. I must stress again, Birch, Bernard, and Lockman published their dictionary from 1734 to 41. That's not too long after this chronological book is released.
You know, and another thing, you know, that Isaac Newton is attacked as crazy for suggesting that chronology was fake and coming out with that book. And then we see Fomenko and Chronology 1, you know, citing Newton and so many other scholars who had questioned the official record. And then when you go through and you start looking at all this stuff, well, it's no wonder. I mean, you know, was Sir Isaac Newton crazy for writing this new chronology? And, you know, I guess he's pretty much who started it all, isn't he?
There are some other skeptics as well. Contemporaries of Joseph Scaliger were actually quite critical of him. So I think right from the very beginning, there was controversy over it. For some reason, that controversy was sort of swept away and it just sort of became accepted. And I'm trying to pinpoint exactly where that happens, but my primary notes, I haven't quite found it yet.
Is it possible that it was the Council of Trent where everything was solidified, and then from there they just go through and burn the books and erase all of this?
Possibly.
You know, because they would have had a couple of hundred years. I mean, if you figure this is, what, four, you know, at least four plus hundred years ago, they would have had, you know, it wasn't in the computer age. They would have had 200 years to go through and collect and burn all of those books. And then we hear of the infamous book burnings in Europe, et cetera. And then these famous libraries getting burned. And what better way to erase the history than to just burn the big libraries?
And just burn them all, as they say. So, yeah, and it's actually, I can actually add a note to that. This is something that I've kind of been thinking about. This is also the time of New Latin or Neo-Latin, where it's kind of like the Latin revival. This is the Renaissance. You're seeing a lot of Latin books.
The revival of Latin?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, quote, unquote. You know, where it's, you know, I see that the inside joke is that apparently Latin was, there's more and more evidence, and McClure, whatever their website, I forget, you know, has also mentioned this, but, and Fomenko mentions this as well, that it appears that they manufactured Latin later on and then actually rewrote it back into history.
So this is where I'm going, because if you look at, like, and we'll be actually reading from this further on, but if you look at, like, Julius Caesar Scaliger, Joseph Scaliger, and their contemporaries, they create Latin pen names, they take all these private manuscripts, and they rewrite them. And I'm going ahead of myself here, and I should hold myself back.
Let me just hold that point, hold that thought, because when you think about Latin being a quote-unquote dead language, right, and it was created, and then, you know, here's the bulk of the words, and then, boom, it's done. We're not going to ever develop it anymore. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think of it, you know, progressing through time, that's one way to look at it. But what if we, like all of this Kabbalah bullshit, excuse my French or Latin, if we just flip it backward the other way, what we see is the reason why it's a dead language is that they created it, they write the dictionaries, and then they place it back into time and say, this is it, no more development of it, and it's the foundational language, by the way.
That's a good way to, if you're a constructed language creator, which we've covered in previous episodes, I mean, that's a good way to cover it up right there, is to have your constructed language and force it back in history and have it in its pristine form at its origin. So that's something that's worthy of looking into. There's a lot of meat there in that bone. So
marrow too.
Oh yeah, that's good stuff. Especially if you're making broth. So
yeah, there you go.
So now I mentioned Julius Caesar Scaliger, it's kind of a nice coincidence that I actually have his biography up here that I read from in the first episode. Now, I don't know if people want me to kind of reread what I read earlier. I could just kind of read it really quick, or I could proceed further on inside of his biography. What do you think there, Jan?
You know, just, I don't know, just dig in, dude.
Okay, so I'm just worried about time constraints, that's all. So,
well, you know, we're halfway through the show. We, you know, we're not really on a time constraint. So if we need to go over like we did the last couple times, we'll just
do it.
Go over, you know, right. People's eyes will just have to bleed through it.
Okay. So this is an original article by Thomas. Oh, actually, before I read this, I just want to make another note about Thomas Birch. I recently discovered an article about, Benjamin Franklin, who is a fellow of the Royal Society, which is interesting as an American. I think it was like either the only American or the first American to become a member. While he was traveling in England, he had this series of letters called the Kyre Book, And this Kyer book was mentioned in his autobiography and had become lost to time, and nobody could find these letters. And recently there was a CNN article within maybe like the last 10 years where this Kyer book had been found in the British Museum. And the reason why nobody could find it was because it's filed under Thomas Birch, because he was a copyist of these letters, and whoever had filed it put it under his name instead of Benjamin Franklin's, which is kind of curious and interesting to think about. So either they could have been rewritten and scapegoated on Thomas Birch, or who knows. But anyway, an original article by Thomas Birch, Fellow of the Royal Society, from a General Dictionary, Historical and Critical, Volume 9, London, 1734 to 1741, page 102 to 104. Scaliger, Julius Caesar, is said to have been descended from the ancient princes of Verona, and was son of Benedict Scaliger, who commanded for 17 years the troops of Matthias Corvinus, king of Hungary, to whom he was related. And Berenice Ladronia, daughter of Count Paris Bagnus. He was born at Ripa, a castle in the territory of Verona, April the 23rd, 1484. And this is according to his son, Joseph Scaliger, from his biography of his father. So, you know, this primary notes about Julius Scaliger's life is coming from the biography of his son, whose chronology we're questioning.
Right. So you can't cite that chronology, because then you get into a begging the question predicament, which is,
oh, sure,
his chronology is under question, because it looks like Joseph Scaliger is a fraud. So then you can't cite Joseph Scaliger on his own family's history when there's all of these contradictions in it.
That's interesting. Yeah. There's all these contradictions. So if you want to cite him about his history of his family, it's kind of difficult, because
it's a great big begging the question argument, you know, and then that's of course a fallacy. So then you have to drop it and move on and just say, hey, you know, the logic of Scaliger fails. And, you know, just understanding that any contradiction is a lie or an error. Why would Scaliger have contradictions in his own history? And then, since we're questioning that, it becomes begging the question, which we then therefore can't cite his own chronology for substantiation of his own arguments, you know.
Wow. Oh, you really took that to the next level. That was pretty cool.
Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my brain.
It's a wild ride.
All right, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, so there's a footnote in there after ancient princes of Verona. And I've read this earlier, but I'll read it now because it's going to help us as we progress. So, said to have been descended from the ancient princes of Verona, Joseph Scaliger, his son, asserts this. But this assertion seems to be contradicted by the letters of naturalization granted by Francis I, King of France, to Julius Caesar Scaliger, in which the mention of such a descent would not have been omitted if it had been well-founded. Whereas he is styled there only Doctor of Physique, he takes there the name of Julius César de l'Escale de Beaudoms, which last word, Mr. de la Manoia, who is a Jesuit, supposes ought to be read Bordoni. This omission of a point over the I before the letter occasioning it to be read Bordoms. He calls himself there also a native of Verona, because he was born in the territories of that city, and because that city was better known in France than the castle of Ripa. Some authors have attacked the nobility of Scaliger's family, and pretend doesn't necessarily mean they're faking at this time in history. When you think about the English language, it also could mean suggest. I mean, they're putting something forward. So, and pretend that he was a son of schoolmaster of Verona.
It's almost portend rather than pretend, or no?
I kind of think of it that way. I was looking at Samuel Johnson's dictionary and I forgot to put the actual dictionary. I was going to embed the definition right into this so I could speak about it, and I forgot. And I don't want to pull it up on my...
Yeah, we need to use definitions from, you know, 400 years ago, not now.
Yes. And Samuel Johnson is a contemporary of these authors of the dictionary and knew them. So I figure, you know, who better than him to relate to when we're speaking about their language. So anyway, pretend that he was a son... Okay, so some authors have attacked the nobility of Scaliger's family and pretend that he was the son of a schoolmaster of Verona named Benedict Bodin, who, going to settle at Verona, took the name Scaliger because he had a ladder for his arms, or because he lived in Ladder Street. Thuanus observes that Augustin Niphus, who I have found in some of my research was Julius's teacher at Padua, was the first inventor of this story, and tells us in his life that when he passed through Padua, Niphus endeavored to persuade him of the truth of that fiction, which he had invented out of resentment against Julius Caesar Scaliger, who in his writing has not shown regard enough for the works of Niphus, his grandfather, and in his common conversation preferred Pomponatius before him. But Joseph Scaliger assures us that Melchior Guyandin and Anthony Riccoboni were the first who pretended to attack his family and supplied Robert Titius with the stories related by him upon that subject. Now, I would like to also note that there's other sources that have also contributed to the Scaliger name fraud. Last episode, I read from Paulus Aemilius Scioppius, could not find his annals containing proof of Julius and his son's relationship to the Della Scala family. Essentially, Julius Scaliger found the history of his family in the annals of Paulus Aemilius in Bavaria, but not a single scholar in Bavaria has been able to find this book. Nobody can verify the citation. So a lot of the foundation of where Julius is trying to assert his heraldry is in a book that nobody can find. Not the governor.
And so therefore doesn't exist. And no other historian, no other contemporary historian knew anything about its existence. It's cited nowhere else but by Scaliger himself to substantiate his own heraldry.
Yeah, so essentially, I'll just read a little bit of the quote right here. Being a little curious, I've thought proper to make some inquiries about Paulus Aemilius, this is Scioppius speaking, who is a friend of Joseph Scaliger's. First, is it likely that Aemilius was ever in Bavaria and understood the oldest German language? And in what corner of Bavaria did he find those annals of the Scaliger family, when they had escaped the utmost diligence of Aventius, Hundius, Lazius, and even the Bavarian Scaligers himself? Was it possible that the illustrious Marcus Valserus, governor of the city of Augsburg, a singular ornament of the age, could not have discovered those annals in some place or other? Has any man once heard the least thing? You say that there were four books of Catullus. Of that book of Aemilius? To this, Joseph Scaliger replied that a great many books were still unknown, so that no one ought to conclude that Paulus Aemilius's had never existed because it was not to be found. He proved Scioppius guilty of an untruth, for Julius Scaliger had not declared that Paulus Aemilius had translated his work from the German language. Now, this is kind of interesting that the charge is that you can't find the book, to which Joseph says, you said that Aemilius wrote it, translated from Bavarian. It wasn't written Bavarian. This wasn't the argument. He's completely deflecting. He's like throwing like almost like a red herring or something out there and saying, here, catch this set. Go over there and follow this. Don't look over here, but you can't find the book.
Straw man, yeah.
So Scioppius via a pen name, which is quite popular this time. His pen name was Scioppius is a pen name too. So Gaspar Schulp, who is Jasper Scioppius, created a pen name, Operinus Grubinius. And from this pen name, he responded to Scaliger and said, I grant you that your father's words, by which he says that Aemilius translated into Latin the Bavarian annals, were not rightly understood by Scioppius, which, however, may still admit to dispute. But I deny that Scioppius introduced them, as though they were the object or were the subject he designed to contend about. And this could still be disputed because the book has not been found, so no one can verify what language it was actually written in and what it was translated from. So you can kind of see this little game that Joseph is playing, where he's just playing with logic.
You know, and here's the thing, is what he's doing is he's using sophistry to create a bogus argument to deflect from the fact that the onus of proof falls on him to substantiate his own claims. So if he really wanted to substantiate his own claims, rather than creating a bullshit argument of distraction and strawmans, he would just present the freaking book and then, you know, and then, you know, be able to verify the not only his translation, but the original Bavarian copy and substantiate his own argument. So what you have here is a massive arguing the arbitrary, which therefore in logic, Scaliger's argument is dismissed by default. So therefore you can just entirely dismiss the claims that he's making. He cannot substantiate his own claims.
No, not at all. I mean, as episode one, we said this is kind of like, you know, an earlier incarnation of trolling.
Right. It's historical trolling, and you know, they're playing psychological warfare against their own, right? Oh, and then this bleeds out. Yeah, this bleeds out into the rest of society forevermore. For the next 400 plus odd years, we're still dealing with, you know, this half-wit Scaliger's sophistry.
Yeah, it's hopefully, you know, it's a battle worthy of fighting, and hopefully others can kind of come on board and help us figure out where.
Yeah, you know, when you understand the onus of proof versus arguing the arbitrary, you can see the tactics, the fallacious tactics that Scaliger is using, and you know, and you can just dismiss his whole argument once you understand that it's on him. It's only on him to substantiate his own argument. And, you know, and I've talked about this in other shows. I've used the example, if I'm claiming there's a green fairy on my shoulder, it's on me to prove it's there. You know, so what he's doing is he's claiming that there's a green fairy on his shoulder, and then like these new age spiritualists, you know, there's a green fairy. Oh, you don't believe me. Oh, Jacob, you're not spiritual enough. You need to go meditate. You know what? I know what you need. You need some ayahuasca. You need some peyote. I got some mushrooms for you. And then, you know, you'll be able to see this fairy on my shoulder. And, you know, and then somehow my argument is magically valid, you know.
You just reminded me of my driving school instructor who told me that her father took LSD once and thought he saw pink elephants running across the street and drove his car into a shop. Anyway, just a little aside. Don't do drugs, kids. So we're getting back to the topic here. Now we're talking about the Scaliger name. Now why would Julius want to create this fraudulent name? Well, let's consider potential reasons for this fiction. The death of Julius's father, brother, and mother had supposedly reduced Julius to great necessity, as in poverty. Is he not from a noble family? Is there no inheritance after their death? No land? No family Bible or other record? They're related to, I believe, was it King Matthias? So obviously there's some genealogical record that should be able to be found going back to these other families. In what circumstances one capable of commanding an army and fathering a family, speaking of Julius's father, but incapable of leaving an inheritance to an orphan son? A father still capable of educating his son, supposedly under the wing of Emperor Maximilian, as, and I've read this elsewhere in another dictionary, I can't quite find where it was, but as a page of the Night Chamber. I don't know where Joseph came up with that one, but I need to find that quote. And he was also educated at the University of Padua. So perhaps his father is actually Benedetto Bordone. According to the Jesuit Girolamo Tiraboschi, who was born on the 18th of December, 1731, and died 9th of June, 1794. He wrote in 1787, Storia della letteratura italiana, that one may find publications of Giulio Bordone Padovano in Italy. Perhaps Julius is simply an educated man who worked as a doctor to support himself. The Della Scala name he used to award himself fame, honor, and respect, elevating himself further than any well-educated doctor, and to offer him greater opportunity to be published. This noble name also comes in handy when courting the lady of a noble family. To acquire such a hand, one must also possess noble stock. Let us examine where the fictional history of Julius Scaliger disappears and reality begins to appear. I'd like to note that there's just a little bit of a gap in Scaliger's biography and the official top portion, which I left out, detailing mostly falsified accounts of his early life, but I discussed it in part one. I will proceed to the quotes. The Bishop of Agen, who was of the family of Le Rovere, being indisposed, engaged Scaliger, who had now gained a very considerable skill in physic, to accompany him to his diocese, which Scaliger consented to, on condition that he should stay at Agen but 8 days. But an incident which happened upon his arrival in that city fixed his residence there. He immediately fell in love with a young lady of a good family named Andiette de Roque Lobjac, whom he desired of her parents in marriage. But they refused him on account of her being so young, for she was then but 13 years old, whereas he was 42. However, he obtained her 3 years after and married her in 1529. He lived with her 29 years and had 15 children by her, 7 of whom survived him. It was after his settlement at Agen that he began to apply himself seriously to his studies and learned at first the French tongue, which he spoke perfectly well in 3 months, and then made himself master of the Gascon, Italian, Spanish, German, Hungarian, and Slavonian. Slavonian is interesting. Jan and I were trying to figure out where that language comes from.
It's apparently proto-Serbo-Croat, proto-Serbo-Croatia, Croatia.
Possibly that, or it could be
Prussia.
Prussia as well. And I was looking at the Prussian one just before we started. It almost seems like that one might be a little more correct. We will see also in future episodes that Daniel Heinsius, he is a former student and, according to him, a sort of adoptive son of Joseph Scaliger. In his funeral relation to Joseph Scaliger, he lists a number of languages that Scaliger is said to have known, but has been later dismissed by Jacob Bernays in his analysis of Joseph Scaliger's Hebrew. So it almost seems like I've been reading that it's almost like a certain level of prestige is added to these scholars where they kind of fluff up their knowledge a little bit further than what it actually was. And some of the writings I've kind of been looking at have been kind of saying that some of the languages have been falsified and he never actually knew them, which is a little bit curious. So back to Scaliger. The chief practices of Julius's studies was polite literature. He practiced physic by which he supported himself. And in his letters of naturalization, he has the title of Doctor of Physic given him, which shows that what Melchior Guyandin informs us via that he had taken that degree in the University of Padua is very probable, but the time is not known. These letters of naturalization were granted him in March 1528, which is, I believe, 1 year before he is married to his lovely young bride. So you can kind of see there's a little bit of an importance where he needs to get this down on paper or something, or he needs to kind of set his name, and it's when he moves to Agen where this name really sets in stone. He's also cited elsewhere as using this name with one of his friends around the same time. So it's almost like this is about the time when he really starts to take on this Scaliger name. So these letters of naturalization were granted him in March 1528, and import that about 4 years before he had retired to the city of Agen, which must not be understood too strictly, since it appears from his life written by his son Joseph that he did not remove to Agen till the end of the year 1525 or the beginning of 1526, which is right around the time where he first met his wife when she was about 13. He did not begin to publish any of his works till he was 47 years old, but he soon repaired the time he had lost and in a short time gained a great name in the Republic of Letters. He died of retention of urine October the 21st, 1558, in the 75th year of his age, and was interred in the Church of the Hermits of St. Augustine. His person was very graceful and noble, and of vigorous constitution. He looked like you were just about to say something.
Oh, I was just saying we should probably look up the importance of that specific church and saint and find out why he's interned there.
Yeah, that's a note I took down for further research that I'll be going into. His person was very graceful and noble and of a vigorous constitution. He had so strong a memory, even in his old age, that he dictated to his son Joseph 200 verses, which he had composed the day before and retained without writing them down. Now, a lot of these accounts come from Joseph about his father. He was a man of great charity, for his house was, as it were, an hospital for the poor and sick. He had such an aversion to lying that he would have no correspondence with those who were subject to that vice. Probably had a hard time talking to himself. He had an admirable sagacity in discovering the disposition and manners of men by their physiognomy. And it is said that he never failed in his judgments of that sort. Now, there's a footnote in there called footnote B, which relates to his works. It's important to read this, especially this first one. The catalog of them follows. Number one, Exodera Carum, Exercitationem, Liber Quintus, Decums, De, I think I misspelled that, De Substitulate, Ad Hieronymum, Cardan, printed in Paris, by Michael Vascolzen in 1557. In Fortio, I make a little note here that says that Julius dies in 1558, and all further publications are posthumous. Basel in 1566, Frankfurt 1576 and 1592, and in Hanau in 1634. Scaliger gave these exercitations the title of the 15th book, because before he wrote it, he had, as he observes, composed 14 other volumes under the same title, which had no relation to Cardan. But none of these volumes ever appeared. What is very, very remarkable is that Scaliger, in his confutation of Cardan, would not read the second edition of his book, De Subtilitate, printed in Basel in 1560 in folio, in which Cardan had made a great number of corrections. Scaliger, being apprehensive that he should by that means be deprived of many occasions of triumphing over his antagonist. Besides, learned men have not judged so favorably of Scaliger's performance as did he himself. Monsieur, I should have emphasized a little bit more, Monsieur de la Monnoye thinks his style to be unequal, barbarous in some places, affected, and bombast in others. And nowadays assures us that he has committed more mistakes than he has censured in Cardan, that the answer of the letter entitled Actio Prima in Calumniatorum Librorum de Subtilitate was an effectual one to Scaliger's criticism. However, Scaliger, who is remarkable for his great opinion of himself, imagined that his work had been the death of Cardan, who died of vexation to see himself so thoroughly confuted. Upon this endeavor to claim a new merit for his compassion towards his antagonist, he wrote a preface in which he highly applauds Cardan and declares an extreme regret for having gained a conquest of so great, or gained a conquest which cost the Republic of Letters so dear by the loss of so great a man. But his regret had not the least foundation, since Cardan survived him 18 years. Scaliger dying in 1558 and Cardan not till the year 1576. Wow.
You know, it's just amazing their level of sophistry and spin, you know.
It's like, it's, I can't see you, therefore you're dead. He's just completely avoiding him.
Peekaboo, you know, yeah.
Oh. Anyway, were they eating tomatoes off of lead plates or something? What was going on?
Man, wow. Yeah, for sure. Eating too much... who knows, wormwood or something. Belladonna.
Yeah. So book three of his, Commentaria in Aristoteles ad Scriptos Libres to De Plantis, printed in Geneva in 1566 in folio, in Marburg in 1598 in 8vo. Aristotle had written upon plants, but the work above mentioned is not his. That's a book by Scaliger about Aristotle about plants that wasn't written by Aristotle. Whoops. Book four, Aristotelius Historia, Animalium, Liber X, Ac Versione and Cum Commentario, Lulli Caesaris Scaligeri, printed in Lyon in 1584 in 8 VO. This edition, a part of the work of Aristotle, was printed a considerable time before the entire work, which was published after Scaliger's death by Mr. de Maussac under this title, Aristoteles Historia Animalium, Graece, Latine, Ex Versione, and Cum Commentarius, Julius Caesar Scaligeri, Edente, Cum Prolegomenis, Animadversionibus, Fragment Eusdem, Historiae, and Indicibus, Filippo Jacob Mausico. Printed in Toulouse, we mentioned that earlier, where as a Jesuit college being there, in 1619 in folio. Scaliger in his translation has not confined himself to the words of his author. In order to represent his sense the better. But this is a liberty which Hucius in his book De Interpretatione thinks to be of dangerous consequence and liable to error. Now, I was thinking about this, about how authors take these manuscripts, these translations, and they take poetic license over them to kind of fluff them up, because back then the tongue was a little barbaric. So to add a little more poetry to their meaning as they would be as contemporary today, I'll think of him as if he were me and I were him, and then I'll write it again. And that seems to be what we have here, is Julius Scaliger fluffing up what is supposed to be Aristotle's work. Why not just, you know, be truthful and not lie and just write down what Aristotle said word for word?
Right. Well, you know, and then we have, like, Fomenko points out to this guy, what was his name? Platonius or something like that, who then is who finds and publishes Plato's work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So, you know, and it's not to say that, you know, Aristotle's work doesn't have value. Obviously, it has a huge amount of value. We have critical thinking today, thanks to whomever Aristotle really was in the 1500s, most likely. You know, we see that, you know, we see Scaliger just faking and lying everything. He's an early Edward Bernays, essentially, you know.
Oh, yeah, you can see the propaganda and the influencing of people's minds. I mean, there's...
Right. And then this explains why Edward Bernays' grandfather writes the biography of Joseph Scaliger, whichever.
Well, yeah,
you know, because, you know, they're all propagandists. So now we can see this line of these frauds going all the way back into the 15th century.
Something just popped in my head. So if we're looking at the Bernays family and their ties to sophistry and propaganda, and we want to follow this back into history, and you want to understand every single technique, who better to study than the greatest sophist of them all, who, as I'm seeing right now, is Joseph Scaliger. If you're going to go and you're going to do a scholarly look at all of his writings, and you have access to all these libraries, and you're going to look at the fights that he had, and the conquests, and the arguments with other great minds, all these other sophists, just think of all the fallacious arguments you can mine out of there and then repurpose for yourself by building your own toolbox, that you could pull out all the different fallacies, all the different techniques, all the different ways that other people subvert the intelligence of others. So it almost seems like there is definitely a reason why. I mean, Edward Bernays borrows from what his uncle Sigmund Freud's work. We know that the family likes to share their information. They know that they like to...
As well as the family relation. I mean, Edward Bernays is like the double nephew of...
Yeah.
Freud, so they're sharing more than that, you know.
They're sharing their blood a little too much.
Yeah, right, a little, you know, like the incest for, you know, Parker Brothers game, you know.
Yeah. So if we're looking at this sophistry, you know, I was looking up some other leads, and a name kind of came up that was interesting by the name of, and it was kind of interesting because of Petavius, and this name was Dionysius of Halicarnassus. who was born in 60 BC and died sometime after 7 BC. He came up with this technique called Dionysi.
Well, BC, I was talking about, yeah, you know.
Well, we could say even he, because who knows if this is actually who we think is. But anyway, that's...
Right. Yeah, go ahead. I was just like talking about the BC chronology, right?
So Dionysian imitatio is a literary method of imitation as formulated by Dionysius, who conceived it as the rhetorical practice of emulating, adapting, reworking, and enriching.
Wait a second. So what you're saying is you create a 1,000-year gap to cover up the actual time period of the Inquisitions that were to suppress the Bacchanalia in Europe, which were... Bacchus was another name for Dionysus. And then you have Dionysus imitatus, then
imitatio
writing this new purporting this history. Are you a coincidence theorist, Jacob?
I don't really necessarily believe in a series of thousands of coincidences.
Yeah, a series of thousands. you'd have to have your head lodged way up there to look at many coincidences. It's like the probability factor is like one in, some probably trillion when there wasn't even that many people.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of Dionysuses out there, and they all seem to have a tie to history. But that's probably something we're going to have to leave for another part, because I could probably expand on that for an hour.
You don't want to investigate everybody by the name Dennis? Is that what you're...
No, I mean, I am investigating everybody, but I just don't want to get ahead of myself. This is something. Yeah, this is like a little teaser of somewhere we're going to be going. But Dionysus...
There will be a part three to this, folks, by the way.
Oh, and maybe a four.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dionysius' concept marked a significant departure from the concept of mimesis, formulated by Aristotle, which is interesting, in the 4th century BC, which is only concerned with imitation of nature and not imitation of other authors. Latin orators and rhetoricians adopted Dionysius' method of imitatio and discarded Aristotle's mimesis. Okay, so... this leads me to what is kind of the conclusion of my outline. And we're kind of seeing the progression here where Julius Scaliger creates a fraudulent name, or not necessarily creates, he steals it from an actual name that had gone extinct and claimed it as his own. Then his son Joseph supported all of this and attacked anybody who questioned it. And then we also see that even then Julius's works, he likes to take on this Dionysian imitatio and imitate Aristotle, who is against imitating others.
Well, yeah. Aristotle was kind of in general about, remaining consistent with reality, which is he's kind of the anti-sophist in a way.
So, and not only that, but Julius Scaliger writes a lot about Aristotle. He's got this big love affair about Aristotle, yet he writes about Aristotle in ways that Aristotle would be like, hey, dude, don't write about me like that. You're totally changing my words around. You're twisting them. Like, he would totally disagree with what Julius is doing. But he's the one that's kind of bringing a lot of Aristotle's knowledge out, because he works in physics. And if you look at the New Latin is a time where they're creating a lot of the Latin Greek names for animals and, a lot of the scientific names basically throughout our encyclopedias. The taxonomy. So we're talking about people in France, especially Julius, who lived in France.
You know, how do we always end up with some problem in France? I'm kidding. Everyone in France.
Oh, yeah. I love the French.
Everybody picks on the French.
And I'm going to pick on them right now, unfortunately.
All right, go ahead.
It's in history. So I was doing some research, and when I kind of pull grammar out of it, sometimes interesting things pop up. I found a later edition of this dictionary I'm reading from. Technically, this is this comes from selections of Mezu's translation of Pierre Bayle's dictionary. So this quote I'm taking right now is coming from Bayle and translated by Mezu, not John Lockman. Okay, so this is from the article French Romances and Scarce Histories. This is just an excerpt. We're not going to read the whole thing. Although I could if you want me to.
I think we can wrap it up after this.
Yeah, we can wrap it up. This is about where I'm going to end. So I could read the entire article. I could just read what I have here on this page right now.
Just read the highlights so we don't bore the audience to tears or whatever, you know. And you know what? What page are you on? I can show it on screen there while you're reading.
Well, it's right in between a page bind and you're going to some stuff from my outline.
What page?
I got to ask you not to show it because there's stuff in my outline that I don't want people to see for the future episodes.
All right. Well, fine. I won't show it. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, teased you there.
Unless you can get it on the screen where that's not showing underneath it.
Well, yeah, I wasn't, you know, I was just going to show what you have, but go ahead, just read it. Go.
Yeah, I just don't want to give too much away. So this is from French Romances and Scarce Histories from an abridged selection of passages from Mezu's translation of Bayle's Le Dictionnaire Historique et Critique. It is an unhappy thing that Madame de Jardin, who was a 17th century French author, talking about people in the 17th century
what's the name again?
The name of the passage?
De
Jardin.
Is that related to Pierre?
I'm curious about it. I don't know.
Would be a whole other connection, just like we have with the Bernays family. That would be another connection with Chardin, into all of the eugenics and stuff going on. And he was a Catholic priest and all of this stuff, and then he creates the Omega Point Theory, which then becomes Terence McKenna's bullshit Time Wave Zero Theory, and then, you know, and then we have the CIA spouting this shit everywhere, you know.
Well, that's what I kind of brought up. That's what I brought up earlier, if you wanted me to read the entire selection.
Yeah, just go.
Because I don't have it pulled up. So Madame de Jardin, she's widowed twice. Her first husband died, her second husband died. In between somewhere there, she became a nun, left the nun, married her second husband. So I don't know if she had any children or not. I think she kind of just, after her second husband died and she took all the money from her two husbands, started writing books and became well known in the literary circles of France. That's kind of the gist of what was before this. So it is an unhappy thing that Madame de Jardin, a 17th century French author, should have opened a way to a liberty that is daily more and more abused, which is to father our inventions and love intrigues upon the greatest men of the later ages, and to mix them with matters of fact that have some foundation in history. This mixture of truth and fiction, which is spread in abundance of new books, spoils the taste of young people and makes them unwilling to believe what is really credible. It is an inconvenience which daily gains ground by the liberty that is taken to publish the secret amours, the secret history, and etc. of such and such lords famous in history. Booksellers and authors do all they can to make it believed that these secret histories have been taken from private manuscripts. They very well know that love intrigues and such like adventures please more when they are believed to be real than when they are thought to be mere fables. Hence it is that the new romances keep as far on as possible from the romantic way. But by this means, true history is made extremely obscure. And I believe the civil powers will at last be forced to give these new romancers their option, either to write pure history or pure romance, or at least to use crochets to separate the one from the other, truth from fiction. And there's a little asterisk at the end. And it says, and this is from the editors, what would Bayle say to the multiplication of books of a kindred species within the last half century, which indisputably pervert many youthful understandings in respect to historical facts and characters? This interference of the civil power, however, would only make bad worse. which is interesting. So they're questioning a lot of the histories that these children are believing. So this book that is published this in 1826. So you're going back to the beginning of the American Revolution as far as 50 years is concerned for these romanced histories. And what they're saying is now their minds are so confounded, it's hard to tell a fact from fiction. And now if you want to actually set yourself on a path to figure this out, you can make a situation that's already bad something a lot worse, because now House of Cards is falling down. And if you're caught underneath that, you're going to get caught in the rubble. And a lot of bad. Yeah.
So you just point out the problem itself rather than adding to it, you know?
Yeah. So that, I thought that was a rather damning passage in this book. And I felt that would be a really good kind of place to kind of end this, because it really does link into Dionysian Imitatio, and it goes back to reasons why Julius needed to fabricate his history. And it just goes all the way back. You can see him with Aristotle. You can see Joseph and his sophistry and trying to defend his father, you know, creating all these different little fallacies to lead all the critics astray. This is a fascinating work, and I'm really excited. I think part three is going to be really interesting, because I think we're really going to find some depths as far as Joseph is concerned. And I think that's where we'll put our focus next.
All right. So, well, thank you so much again, Jacob, for coming on the show, and thank you for sharing all of your research. Thanks, everybody, for supporting the show. And we'll see you all next week, I presume. I don't know what I'm going to present next week, but anyway, we'll figure it out. Maybe Jacob will be ready for part three by then. We'll see how much pressure we can put on him. All right, everyone. Good night. Enjoy. We'll see you all next week. Take care.
All right. Have a good night.